the midweek drive, zooming into the future and energized by the now.
Cozy we are, closer than far, sounds of forever spill around. Lovers in love, just like we were, 'cause being apart's a lonely sound. And when people ask how we stay together, I say you never let me down. Yeah, you make it feel like Christmas, even when things go wrong. I hear the sound of Christmas in your song. Sun shining on me, nowhere could be a better place. Lovers in love, yeah, that's what we'll be. When you're here with me, it's Christmas Day. 'Cause you make it feel like Christmas, even when things go wrong. I hear the sound of Christmas in your song. Oh, that's how you know that it's true, babe. Just look at us now, part of it all. In spite of it all, we're still around. So wake up the kids and put on some tea. Let's light up the tree. Christmas Day, and you make it feel like Christmas, even when things go wrong. Say now, I hear the sound of Christmas in your song. You know I do, babe. All year long.
It's certainly a truism and a line that we've used frequently, that a cat is for life, not just for Christmas. And we're delighted to actually welcome somebody who's going to speak about our feline friends and connections with respect to that as the festivities obviously approach and so on. We're talking to the rehoming and welfare manager at Battersea. That's Bridie Williams. How are you, Bridie?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Excellent. Now, I mean, we've spoken to a number of people over the years who've really benefited from taking on board a rescue cat or a rescue dog and so on from that point of view. And what you've got at Battersea is something which is hugely significant, because it's almost become a cliche to say that this is the go-to place, but 140 years of caring for the country's cats, not necessarily Battersea's dog's home, obviously line for that, but just looking at these figures, since you took in your first feline friend in 1883, over a quarter of a million cats have been looked after by this particular cat's charity. That must be a source of pride, Bridie.
Yes, it's amazing. We're really excited to be celebrating such a milestone here. And in the 140 years that we've been looking after cats, we've just gone from strength to strength and learning about them and understanding this complex species. And we're now sort of world leading in regards to the cat welfare that we offer and the advice that we can give and support to new homes. So yeah, it's exceptionally wonderful. And I'm very proud to work at Battersea.
I've shared with you many Midweek Drive contributors, some of them indeed Los Angeles, some from this country, a whole range of things who kind of really been taken with their rescue cat. And it is something which I think people often forget, the importance of rehoming cats and so on. Do you feel as though that's a message which is still taking time to get through? Or do you think more and more people are aware of how, you know, something like Battersea can help, but obviously rehoming cats can help in terms of, you know, our friends as well?
I mean, there's always more because we've always got lovely cats looking for homes. It is fantastic how much the message is getting out there that, you know, putting rescue first is definitely a brilliant thing, but we're always sort of trying to champion it. And it's also considering how much you get when you rehome a rescue cat, because obviously you can come in and we can give you all the support and advice to make sure that you're choosing the right cat for you to make it even more likely you'll have a successful rehoming. And then you'll also be doing a wonderful thing for that cat who come into us, and it means that then we've got space for another cat who might need help. So yeah, it's always fantastic to think rescue first and come to places like Battersea.
Is it a never-ending saga? I mean, do you ever get to the stage where you sort of think, surely we've sorted out all the cats now, and then you get another litter that actually arrives?
So I never think, well, that's it, we've done all we can do. There is always more that we're sort of, you know, wanting to help, and there is a list of cats waiting to come in. So we will always be here for every cat and dog for as long as needed. And at the moment, yes, there is still a need for it. So we're still here doing everything we can for them.
And is there still confusion about people who say, oh, it's Battersea Dogs Home, and they don't realise that obviously it caters for both cats and dogs?
Yes, so that is something where a lot of people still do just consider us Battersea Dogs Home. It was in 2005 that cats was added to the name so that people realised that we did both. And we do actually rehome now as many cats as we do dogs. So people are sort of realising that we rehome cats as well, because they're coming forward to rehome via us. But yeah, I still think that when people think of Battersea first, they do quite often think Dogs Home. So we want to shout about the 140 years that we have been here for cats.
And I suppose arguably you're looking for a few 20-year-old cats too in cat years, actually equivalent 140 years of existence.
Yeah. We did actually rehome a 20-year-old cat not that long ago, and we've got a 17-year-old with us now, because we rehome and take in sort of all ages. And at the minute we've got everything from the youngest of kittens right up to our proper super seniors.
Battersea.org.uk, the best place to go to find out further details about the cat anniversary.
Yes, that's true. That's where we've also got like photos of our cats that are up for rehoming, and then there's plenty of advice for people as well there for cats and dogs if they are wanting to learn a bit more.
Yeah, it's probably worth also noting, and I'm sure that our discerning listener will be well aware of this. This is a responsibility. It's not a case of, okay, we're coming up to Christmas, let's get a temporary kitten to actually develop this, or a cat, etc. These are full commitments, and I'm pleased you mentioned, Bridie, that as rehoming and welfare manager, you presumably also vet prospective feline companions.
Yes, we do. And that's one of the great things about coming to places like Battersea, is that we will have informative, proper conversations with people to find out about the sort of temperament they're looking for, their home setup, etc. So then we match their needs with the cat needs. And it means that when we get our updates of how happy they are in their new home, we can see what a great job we're doing at that. And it's just really wonderful to see cats happy in their new homes.
Indeed. Bridie Williams, Rehoming and Welfare Manager at Battersea, huge thanks. And I'm sure many cats around the globe, past and present, will be turning around and saying, yes, yay, go Bridie. Or the
I like that image, yes, thank you.
Now, clearly, the traditional line was a dog is for life, not just for Christmas. Quite rightly so, too. But no, we're now talking about dogs for good, and indeed a whole wave indeed of how our canine companions could effectively connect with families over the festive season. And to talk us through some of the wonderful world of canines and their impacts, behavior really and otherwise, we're delighted to welcome from Dogs for Good, Carrie Miles. How are you, Carrie?
I'm very well, thank you. Lovely to join you and to be representing Family Dog, which is a service within Dogs for Good. And absolutely, dogs can help in so many ways over Christmas. Our focus here with our winter appeal is how dogs can support families with autistic children. And we've found that they can help them just visit family members for the first time, which I think is massively significant.
Now, this is obviously a connection with more than insurance, of course, and they've done some fascinating research which suggests that many dogs have helped save a Christmas in times past by effectively enabling them to start new festive traditions, more meaningful connections, etc. They really do seem to be acting as clear little helpers here in the fullest sense of the word.
Yes, they really are. One parent explained that for their child, their dog brings an extraordinary magic to Christmas, which I think is just a lovely phrase. And exactly, Morvan's research have found that actually 2/3 of dog owners have noticed that their dog allows them to make more meaningful connections. And 79% have created new traditions, one of which, my favorite, is a child creating an advent calendar especially for his dog so that they can do it together every morning.
Dogs, like humans, come in all shapes and forms. Are there any particular breeds of dog that you think actually are well suited for this? I mean, are we talking about collies, terriers, mongrels, Alsatians? What's your own thought?
I think that's a fantastic question. And within the Family Dog Service, we support every single breed, age, shape. So families at every position of having a dog. We've had such a range. I think we calculated over 1,000 different dog breeds and mixes. And we work with the family on an individual basis to find out what kind of dog does support them best.
And from your own perspective, Kerry, with Dogs for Good, have you been a canine companion for some time? Or is it a case of, no, I prefer cats, and you'll shock the world?
So I'm definitely a dog person. I'm a canine behaviourist, and dogs have just been a massive part of my life throughout, but I do appreciate a good cat.
Good diplomatic answer, I feel. Now, obviously, Christmas can be a very frantic time. It can be a very fraught time. And it's probably important to actually have a series of tips to ensure that canines feel part of the thing, but also don't get hyper. And one of the annual things we always have to put out at this time of the year is, for goodness sake, avoid chocolate. However much you might sort of think, oh, it'll be a little treat, etc. It could end up in all sorts of challenges. Anything you'd like to add in terms of some of the tips that Dogs for Good and More Than have actually produced to actually make the most of your dog at Christmas?
Absolutely. So the chocolate thing is a really good point. I will say the advent calendar for the dog was dog-friendly food, definitely not chocolate. And some of the main tips are making sure that the dog isn't becoming overwhelmed. It's very common for people to have lots of parties, lots of visitors, music, friends, fireworks even. So ensuring that the dog has their own place to retreat to during the day, quiet time, and plenty of sleep as well.
So clearly, effectively ensuring that they're not sensory overload in that kind of category, because it can be stressful for humans as well as dogs from that point of view. And in terms of obviously the seasons, the weathers, etc., would you say it's also good and healthy for both human beings and their canine friends to get some exercise and do some walking as well together over the festive period?
Absolutely. Morvan's research found that a massive portion of families create a Boxing Day tradition or a Christmas Day tradition of a dog walk, which is a fantastic opportunity for the whole family to get out, get some fresh air, enjoy the weather. If you like the cold, I certainly do. And it just brings a sense of joy and union, harmony to the Christmas period. So definitely a really good idea for everyone's headspace as well as your dog's well-being as well.
I was interested in terms of the notion of how dogs interact with other dogs. I mean, we had obviously with the lockdown scenario, a number of cases where I think dogs were having to be re-socialized and deal with obviously encountering other animals. Is that getting less of a challenge these days?
That's a really good question. And I think the general climate of society has changed massively since lockdown. We certainly found within the Family Dog Service, there was an increased desire for support. So we provide lifelong support to the families that do our workshops. And we had a lot of parents needing support for dogs that weren't able to have that socialization during lockdown. So it's quite high at the moment, and it can take a long time for dogs to recover from that. So as they are maturing, it might be a problem that still arises. But luckily, we're here to support families with autistic children with everything to do with that.
Fantastic. And would you like to just share with us once again how people can actually get involved or indeed find out more about Dogs for Good and this particular project?
Absolutely. So all of our information can be found on the Dogs for Good website, so dogsforgood.org. You can have a look at the family dog service there and read all about our lovely stories in our winter appeal and some of the families that we have supported.
Gary Miles from Dogs for Good, huge thanks, and have a fantastic festive period. By the way, what's the breed of your dog who chose you as his or her companion?
That's an excellent question. I have a rescue street dog from Romania, and I've had her DNA tested, and she's a quarter Chihuahua, Maltese, Pekingese, Belgian Shepherd, and 100 other things.
Perfect. Obviously, a complete canine collaboration aspect there in full force. Gary Miles from Dogs for Good, as we said, happy holidays.
I'm not dreaming of a white Christmas. All I'm dreaming of the whole day long is a peaceful one. Merry Christmas, Happy New Year to those of you who live in fear. And let us hope that very soon the peace you seek will then resume. I'm not dreaming of a white Christmas. I'm not dreaming of a white Christmas. All I'm dreaming of the whole day long is a peaceful.
A warning for possible canine friends who might be listening to this. You might want to cover your ears with your paws at present because it could be a little bit painful in all sorts of ways. Apparently, 36% of dog owners believe that castration is a responsible part of dog ownership. And yet the majority aren't aware of what non-surgical procedures are available for our four-legged friends. So let's talk a little bit about this with somebody who certainly knows all about these particular issues, TV vet extraordinaire. It's Dr. James Greenwood. How are you, Dr. James?
Hi, I'm very well, thank you. It's quite a topic for us to discuss on a December day,
well,
isn't it?
this is the key point. I mean, absolutely. And it's a little bit of an advisory to start off that.
Like that.
Yeah, this approach or research from Opinium does suggest that dog owners clearly want to be responsible, but they also, 1 in 10 of them, worry about being judged by society if they decide not to employ surgical castration with their dogs. So is there an alternative, first and foremost, James, when you actually get that high testosterone notion and you say basically, well, just basically get them castrated?
Yes, absolutely. There's lots of things for us to consider here. And I think I think, first of all, you know, exactly as you said, the fact that owners are wanting to do the right thing, I think is great. You know, the fact that people engage with this is brilliant. But what has changed slightly is the evidence and the studies around castration and the long-term effects that that might have on our dogs. So it's not that castration is wrong by any means, and it's not that those owners are wrong if they have chosen to castrate their dogs, but it's just about making sure that we're following what the studies show and people being aware that there is a medical option out there as well to consider as an alternative. So, you know, we talk about testosterone, and I think, you know, there is that sort of societal, I think it is a little bit of a judgment or an expectation that if you see a dog with, you know, everything intact and they're entire, that somehow might suggest that they're more likely to be an aggressive dog. But aggression is such a complicated area, and to sort of label a dog as being aggressive is a very simplistic way to talk about it. And testosterone, it certainly is not an aggression hormone. If anything, it's a confidence hormone. So by castrating certain dogs that are already struggling, maybe with certain anxieties or worries, we could even actually worsen some of those behaviors. So it's all about making sure that we look at this on an individual basis, as opposed to the kind of the traditional kind of one rule fits all, which is that all dogs should be castrated. We need to just slightly pull back from that and look at this as a bigger picture.
It's fascinating to see that there are studies in the United States and Europe that suggest that neutering a dog under the age of 6 months could actually increase their risk of joint pain, cancer, and obesity, all key areas there, which clearly, I suppose, suggests that maybe the reason the parts are there in the first place is because there is a purpose for them.
Well, this is it, you know, and I think what's interesting is that in the UK, we've actually got the highest castration rate of any country in Europe, which I was quite surprised when I heard that, you know, but it is so... It's so ingrained, I think, almost culturally, that we have dogs in our lives. They're a part of our family, but it's still this kind of very much sort of hangover effects from, I suppose, when maybe in the 60s and dogs were much more sort of free to roam, you know, much more like our cats would be today, you know, that you sort of open the door and let the dog out and they would just go for the day and then come back later. Of course, we don't do that anymore, which meant that there was a huge problem with overpopulation and these sort of the awful term unwanted litters. But essentially, that was what was happening. So there's this sort of boom and normalization that, you know, you should have your dog neutered for you to be responsible. And I think at the time, you know, it would be hard to argue against that. But dog ownership has changed. You know, things have changed. Stuff has moved on. We've got studies that have sort of looked at the effects of that. And certainly it's looking much more like certainly larger breed dogs. So, you know, your Rottweilers, your large Labradors, your Great Danes, that are neutered very young before they've reached either sexual or skeletal maturity, you know, there are studies now that show that that could lead to some of these problems later on in life, as well as the behavioral component as well, like we've said about them, maybe even slightly worsening rather than improving some of the behaviors too. So, we can't ignore that. I think that's the thing, you know, as vets, we're slightly changing the advice here. You know, I think traditionally 10, 15 years ago, you'd have gone to the vets and they'd said, yes, absolutely, we'll get them if be neutered. But now it's slightly changing. And it's sort of saying, really, what we need to do is just don't rush. You know, let's look at your dog as an individual as they grow. And certainly we need to let them reach maturity before we consider either medical or surgical castration.
Would you advise communication with your vet in terms of if you are thinking about a possible way forward, that it's best to at least talk through the options and bearing in mind that each dog is obviously unique in its own way?
Yeah, 100%. That really is the sort of the key take home message here, just to say, you know, you might sort of feel under pressure to have the expectation that you're going to neuter your dog, but actually the you know, as vets, we're much more sort of now saying we need to have that conversation rather than saying what's right or wrong. It's certainly not a black and white argument. And the great thing about the sort of the option for medical castration is that it does allow a kind of a temporary option. So you use it's an implant that goes under the skin without an anesthetic, but it allows the testosterone levels to drop, which gives you almost like you can kind of dip your toe into the water without committing. You know, you can kind of try before you buy and see how your dog copes with that as an individual, and then either consider repeat medical castration or, you know, possibly consider surgical castration. But it's just an option for you to be aware of as well. And there might even be times where we team up with a clinical animal behaviorist and actually go completely the other way and advise against castration if the behavior suggests that that's going to be the best thing for your dog. So I think there's just lots of there's lots of new evidence, there's lots of studies, and I think it's just about being much more sort of open and aware of the implications that castration can have. And it's definitely not wrong. I don't want people to hear this and go, oh my goodness, you know, we did that, we castrated our dog and now, you know, I'm worried. That's not the case at all. It's just about addressing and making sure that you can make, you know, an informed decision for you and your dog moving forward.
Yeah, I like the try before you buy. I think that's interesting because obviously you don't want to have an irrevocable option. And that's pretty much what the case is, basically, if the castration option is actually taken, really. There's not really a case of, well, we can always put them back.
Once they're off, we can't put them back on, sadly, no.
Absolutely. Although I'm sure science will improve in certain ways.
You never know. Never know.
Dr. James Greenwood, it's been fascinating as ever. Would you like to just point people in the direction of where people can find more details about this research from Opinium, or indeed follow your good self, Dr. James?
Yeah, well, so the study is the Opinium study. I think the best place to go, honestly, you know your dog better than anybody else, and also your vet does too. So my first port of call, honestly, would be to say have a discussion with your vets. And you can find me on socials. I'm at Dr. J Greenwood, but otherwise, you know, more important is to just have that relationship with your vets, to have that conversation.
Fantastic. Dr. James Greenwood, originally from Yorkshire, I see, which is always
absolutely
good. And known for a number of key vets. Yeah. A certain Alf White, I think, was actually there. Oh, is that James Harriet? One of the two. I never
again.
Exactly. but for the moment, many thanks indeed. Take care and keep on keeping on, Dr. James.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Have a happy holiday. Gather around the Christmas tree. This Christmas. Waking up to hear the sound. Snow is falling on the ground. This Christmas. Shining bright by candlelight. Loved ones standing by your side. Don't be alone this Christmas. Smiling faces all around. Paint the town red and white this Christmas. Yeah, this Christmas. So have a merry Christmas. Share the love and Christmas wishes. Enjoy yourself this Christmas. Fill your heart with festive spirit. Stockings to the brim this Christmas. Choir singing at the door. Snowman building all the lawn. Let's have some fun this Christmas. Set the table, write the cards. Bring the food and live at large. Don't be a Scrooge this Christmas. Oh, this Christmas. So
enjoy yourself.
Now, it may well be that when you're looking for home improvements and such like, you may have your own particular viewpoint in terms of what is the best thing to actually do. But certainly when we start talking about doing things for your mates, that's a whole different issue. And we're delighted to actually talk about this particular challenge with two fine folk today. First of all, Stacey from Direct Line. How are you, Stacey?
Morning, Alex. I'm good, thank you.
Excellent. And indeed, engineer, a tradesperson himself, Kevin Craig. Kevin, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. And it's nice to meet you.
Likewise. Kevin, would you like to just talk us through your own experience in terms of this challenge with respect to mates rates and so on?
Yes, certainly. Would you like me to give you a couple of examples?
Yes, please.
So, the first one was a 20-mile round trip for a job. And it was only a small job, but I decided to do it as it was somebody I knew. Mm. I did the job. And when I asked for the money, he offered to buy me a couple of pints, which I said, well, actually, you know, I want paying really. And he did pay in the end. Another one was a friend of mine. It was a full bathroom installation, full rip out. She'd taken the time off work to help labour. I'd done the job for half price. The problem was she'd ordered these tiles. Well, not ordered. She'd got them for free, job lot. And they were all different sizes because they're different batches. So I'm there doing the job, struggling, getting frustrated, trying to get these tiles to line up on the wall. Then she's on me, she's trying to tell me how to do the job, how we should be doing the job. And we ended up having a massive fallout, really. And I basically said, if you don't pack up, I'm packing up, I'm leaving the job and taking my tools with me. Luckily, we're still friends. And I'm glad to say the job went well. And she's invited me to a wedding next year, which
fantastic.
Is good.
And you may be able to sing at the wedding because, of course, what we didn't say is not only are you an ace plumber, but you're also a singing plumber. So it can work out for the better, can it not, Kevin, sometimes?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely can do.
Having said that, it's not good business practice. So let's turn to Stacey now, because Stacey, obviously, we've heard Kevin's tale there, and he is the singing plumber. Presumably, you're the singing Direct Line soul. Stacey, any thoughts on Kevin's challenge? And in fact, the notion that your research has suggested that mates rates can actually cost tradespeople an average of £1,400 a year.
That's right. I am going to disappoint you on the singing, I'm afraid, but hopefully I'll make up for it. So that's right. About £1,400 a year is what our research respondents at Direct Line told us about in terms of what it costs, what they lose out on by offering either to work for free or to work at mates rates. And that, if you add that up across tradespeople across the UK, that works out at about £1.2 billion a year in lost income, which is a pretty hefty sum. And Kev obviously talked about that in his example about being offered a couple of pints and to pay for the work that he did. But the other example he gave touched on something that we learned about in the research that we didn't necessarily expect to see, and that was around the impact of being asked to do free work on your relationship with the person who's asking you, so your friend or your family member. And about one in four of the people we spoke to said that getting these requests, which can come in quite frequently, about 40% of people said they're frequently asked, and one in four said that it has a negative impact on their relationship with that person. So a takeaway for us collectively is if you are asking someone to work for free or to offer you a discounted rate, it's worth just having a think about what kind of impact that might have in terms of pounds in their pocket, but also frustrations or pressure that they might feel trying to work with you when they're not being paid their full rate.
Thanks, Stacey. I mean, Kevin, you're still fitting bathrooms. You're still sorting those things through. I mean, what Stacey says, would you say, yeah, I'll need to actually record that and just play it back whenever anybody asks me to do something for mates' rates?
Absolutely. For sure.
That's fine. This is great. And I still think, actually, there must be some way in which we can get a duet together. I mean, if we can have the singing plumber, we must actually work on that as well.
Let's do it.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the way forward. You have a record contract. When can people actually hear more Kevin Crane material?
From the new year, I'm going to be working on getting a tour together, which is going to be starting March, April time. It's called the Boom 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 Tour, and it's based around anti-racism in football. Once I've got that under the way, then I'll be back in the studio recording another album.
Fantastic. And if the record producer says, Kevin, would you mind doing this for a couple of pints? Tell him where to go. It's not the first way.
I certainly will. Can I just say, if you want any more information, please go to directlineforbusiness.co.uk.
You've already covered the final question I was going to put to Stacey, but you did it effortlessly well. Stacey, I think we're just left with you saying you need to actually work on becoming a singing direct line salesperson. I think this could be very important for your good self, Stacey.
We will come back if it happens, Alex.
Excellent. Stacey from Direct Line and Kevin Crane, the singing plumber, huge thanks, and keep on keeping on.
Thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Well, I wonder if Sir Walter Raleigh realised the kind of controversy he would have caused in the 21st century when he first decided to introduce the humble potato to the British palate. Probably he actually would have had lots of things to say. But it does seem as though certainly there are lots of issues with respect to what's going to be happening over Christmas Day in particular. 2 million of us are apparently going to go for fries, French fries, or indeed chips, or something for the Christmas Day dinner. We need to get some sense on this. So we've decided to welcome to the programme to discuss the challenge of British roasties and so on from, of course, a Perthshire potato farmer extraordinaire and director of GB Potatoes. That's Ewan Grewal. How are you, Ewan?
Yeah, very well. Thank you, Alex. Nice to speak to you this morning.
Excellent. Okay, Ewan, so what is the challenge? I mean, in essence, this survey, which suggests that 10% of us are actually getting into fights over roast potatoes over Christmas, that's not the meaning of Christmas, is it, surely?
No, definitely not. I think the research by Farmhouse Inns, most importantly, has shown that, you know, 97% of the country love potatoes. And, I'm not sure humble potato is the right word. The British potatoes should be celebrated and not be so humble. A fantastic addition to any plate. I don't think there's too much controversy with the potato. But whether it's chips or roasts or boiled or mashed, all fantastic.
Well, these are the classic things, of course, because I see that actually a third of us are actually now looking to add cheese to their potatoes. That's sacrilege, surely, isn't it? On Christmas Day?
It certainly won't be happening in my house, but, you know, you've got to facilitate the choice. I think that sort of Carberry-type environment where you've got all the choice of potatoes, they're roast, boiled, it's great. I think you've got to celebrate the way people change their habits and just move forward with that. And, you know, we've got Farmhouse Inns. We're going to have a limited edition Bovril roast potato for those booking on Christmas Day. So there's all sorts of different ways to be creative around the potato, which is all to be celebrated.
Okay, so let's take it back to basics. We've got the potato in hand. Does it all start with the peel? Is it the peeling of the potato that effectively can then lead to a good start, which actually means you can then start deciding whether you're going to go roast or boiled and so on?
It's just getting a good potato to start with. So a good British-grown potato, choose a nice, good variety that you know how to work with, that is the same consistent dry matter. So it gives the same sort of cooking result every time. And yeah, once you've got that, whether you leave the skin on with lots of nutrition in the skin or you peel it. So yeah, get that peel right, get the cooking right, and you've just got an amazing product at the end of the day. And which is backed up by the Farmhouse Inn's research. You know, the strong feeling for the love of potatoes is just out there, and that's what we all hope, and as an industry we want to keep and promote.
As we mentioned at the start, of course, you're director of GB Potatoes. Clearly potatoes are key to, I suppose, the sustainable farming industry, because you can obviously, most people can grow potatoes after a fashion. I mean, what led you to this love of potatoes?
Oh, a multi-generational sort of growing of potatoes. We've got a great climate up here in Scotland and Perthshire, just for growing potatoes. Lots of available water, a bit too much this year. Lovely climate for growing sort of good yields of high quality potatoes. So, and it's always been great, the sort of positive feedback that people we sell to, just that love of potatoes, whether it's roast potatoes at your Christmas carvery or whether it's mash or chips. It's just it's a great product that people love, and we've been my grandfather was doing it, my father, the whole family have been for many years, so it's
almost back to Walter Raleigh's
time. We're trying to hone our skills.
Almost back to Walter Raleigh's time. Back in this mention to this survey, I see that gravy is something which tends to divide opinion. Well, given that one of our key presenters' catchphrases is "it's all gravy," is this a north-south divide thing at work, or is it just a case of Southerners clearly don't appreciate the importance of gravy with their potatoes?
Oh, I'm definitely in the gravy camp. So yeah, I can't believe anyone doesn't, but. But yeah, I don't know what the divide is. Certainly just goes well with a Christmas dinner.
Okay, so Ewan, almost final question. What's your key tips to anybody who wishes to have the perfect roast potato? Let's go traditional here. Let's forget about chips. Let's forget about boiled. Let's forget about mash. All of those kind of things actually there. The traditional roast potato, what's the way forward?
You want to get, say, the right variety, the right taste, cooked perfectly in a nice rapeseed oil or goose fat, and just perfect temperature. Get the heat up, and that should lead to a great result. And you know, you go down to a farmhouse in Carvery, they've got a great selection there, different tastes, wide selection, and that. That leads to the perfect result and a perfect place for the family to get together and celebrate Christmas.
And probably leads us to the final line, that potatoes are for life, not just for Christmas. So there we are. Ewan, it's been awesome connecting with your good self. How can people actually find out more details about what we've been chatting about today? Is there a website you'd point them to?
For the Farmhouse Inns, you've got find us at Farmhouse Inns, so and find your local Farmhouse Inn to book your carvery over the festive period, and just there's a few different websites on potatoes, GB Potatoes being one of them, on the industry.
Oh, indeed, and you've managed to work through this entire interview without mentioning, of course, the classic Scottish line, neeps. Oh, not neeps, neeps and tatties, I should say, tatties.
it's St Andrew's day today, but we'll maybe wait for Burns Night for the neeps and haggis, neeps and tatties. But yeah, the good old tatty.
Something to look forward to in January. Ewan Grewer, potato farmer and director of GB Potatoes. Huge thanks and happy holidays.
Thank you very much. Cheers.
Thoughts become things, choose the good ones. And it's the thought that counts. All of these things probably going through one's mind at this particular time of year. But what about the whole notion of pre-love presents and gifting and so on? Well, we've decided to actually bring in a true expert to deal with this. No less a personage than the gift wrap guru herself, of course. Jane Means is with us. How are you, Jane?
Good morning. I'm fine. Very busy, as you can imagine, with Christmas looming around the corner. So it's all stations go here.
Of course. But obviously, one of the key reasons we're featuring on the programme today is because of some research by Royal Mail that shows that more than half of Britons would be happy to receive a second-hand or re-gifted or indeed pre-loved present at Christmas, with only a quarter confessing to taking umbrage. So is this showing a complete sea change in terms of, ultimately it is the thought that counts, and it's not a case of having to break the bank or the budget to effectively say, you've got to have all of these glossy things as well?
I think there's two huge factors going on here. Not only have we got cost of living crisis where, pennies are a little bit short here, but also sustainability. I mean, that's the biggest thing I've seen, certainly in the last 3 years, is that companies and individuals now want to be more sustainable, whether it's wrapping, and like gifting. I mean, I've always done re-gifting. I just have to make a note of who it's come from. And for the first time ever, I've actually sort of said to my partner, I would quite like this particular item from a secondhand clothes website. And he's like, are you crazy? It's secondhand. And I see nothing wrong with it.
I mean, I'm interested. You said you had to keep a list of who has delivered whose gifts, because, of course, it would be a source of possible embarrassment if you simply actually recycle the gift and return it to the person who was actually giving it, let's say, last year or whatever.
Yeah, that must be like the worst thing ever. I don't believe I've ever done it, but God forbid if I have.
Now, you started your company in 1995 with a fairly small budget, a mind full of creative ideas. You started running gift wrapping courses in 1999. What about the wrapping? I mean, I've gone through various phases in terms of this, in terms of obviously the bows, the ribbons, the bells and whistles, and then basically just no wrapping whatsoever. Is there an etiquette in terms of that? Or is it a case of, well, obviously, if you have the outside package put together, it just makes it a little bit more special when the giftee starts unwrapping?
Yeah, I think wrapping to me is a little bit like fashion or, wearing clothes, that you can sort of just add a few touches and accessories, or you can go the full hog and just, go head to toe with a specific fancy outfit. So I look at wrapping a little bit like that. You can do, small to extreme. And I never dreamt, nearly 30 years ago, I started my business. My first course was in Lincolnshire. And, I never dreamt that I would be sort of wrapping for all these like amazing brands and traveling the world. So, it's a really great business to be in, because I think it just brings so much joy.
Well, that's very true. Now, Jane, if people are listening to this and say, well, that's all well and good, but I still have difficulty actually getting the sellotape to actually work, let alone the other sort of bows and ribbons. Is there a kind of standard go-to guide? Do you have YouTube videos, or just a case of, well, buy my book? How do we actually go about wrapping, let's say a book?
Yeah, I have got like plenty of videos on YouTube. It's just at Jane Means, and also Instagram Reels and now TikTok as well, that people just want that short burst of information. So, it's all on there. But I think the key thing for wrapping at Christmas is just try and be organised, have a bit of space, write your tags out, have a glass of sherry, enjoy the moment.
That makes sense. Now, in terms of obviously being eco-friendly and sustainable with our wrapping, again, there's the old line, certainly when it comes to children, that say they find the wrapping paper and the boxes are much more fun to play with than the actual contents of the box. Is that something which, again, we need to be mindful of?
I don't know about you, but I was always brought up, don't rip the paper, because my mum would want to recycle it and reuse it. And I suppose I've been brought up like that. And now it's absolutely acceptable to do that. And even things like when you receive a really well wrapped box and it's pretty sort of good standard paper quality, I know it sounds crazy, crease all the edges and actually slide the box out. And then you can use the sort of carcass of paper as a gift bag for another gift. So there are sort of tricks and ways and means of recycling and being sustainable, and obviously just avoid glitter, plastic foil, and just try and go for recycled or recyclable products that you can reuse.
I noticed that the most popular secondhand gifts are indeed books, followed by toys, jewellery, clothes, computer games and gadgets. I mean, any surprises there? Or is it a case of, well, yeah, books are us. I mean, even in a world where most people have Kindles or electronic devices, etc., that physical book is still somewhat important and special.
I'm a massive book fan, Alex, because the last thing I want to do, certainly when I go on holiday, is get a digital device out. I want to get away from that. So that tangible, that book, that feeling, I love it. And I see nothing wrong with, you know, reselling or re-gifting books at all. Because if you think about it, you know, my local village hall up at Kirby near Stamford, they have, you know, a whole wardrobe full of books, bookcase full of books, rather. And, you know, you go to book clubs, you swap books. You know, when I've read a book, I pass it on to a friend or a family member. So, you know, nothing new there at all in my eyes.
Well, it makes perfect sense, Jane. It's been awesome connecting with you yourself. If people want to find out further details about the Royal Mail's survey, where would you point them?
You will find them on the Royal Mail website. I'm also going to do a little article as well on Instagram all about it, because I think it's a fantastic idea that you can re-gift your gifts, and the postie will do all the hard work until the end of December. So well done, Royal Mail.
Yeah, absolutely. And Jane, if people are actually looking to get hold of an original copy of your own book, where do they actually go? Are they still available online and so on?
I hate to say they've completely sold out, but head over to that secondhand marketplace called eBay, and you can probably get a pre-loved copy.
Well, there you go. Jane Means, gift wrap guru extraordinaire. Huge thanks, and happy holidays, Jane.
And you too, Alex. Thanks for having me.
it home.